We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. You know, I think it's a pretty common belief that brain function declines with age. However, there's some good recent research to show that, in fact, the brain is really more robust than that, and that the brain has the ability to grow and change even as we get older. In this hour focus, we'll be talking with Arthur Kramer. He's professor of psychology here at University of Illinois. His area of research is cognitive neuroscience, and his particular interest is cognitive and brain plasticity across the adult lifespan. We'll talk about a little bit about how the brain changes as we get older. We'll also talk about the ways that maybe some forms of intelligence actually can improve with age. We'll also look at the importance of exercise, both mental and physical, because there is also a good reason to believe that doing that, having both those kinds of exercise, is good to preserve cognitive functioning, and it may be good for everyone, and it may indeed be good for people who are struggling with various kinds of dementia. So as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. I know that our guest will do his best to answer questions. People are invited to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we also have email, so if you'd like to submit your question that way, you can do that. Write will-talk@illinois.edu. Any point here, questions certainly are welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
I do think that, and maybe this would be a good place to start, that people, it is a very commonly held belief that decreases in cognitive functioning are something that just go with age. And I'm sure that people have heard this thing, this old saw that says, when you're born, you got all the brain cells that you're ever going to have, and that over time, slowly, they're going to die. Mm-hmm. Now, apparently, we know, based on recent research, that in fact, that is not true.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly the case. There are many different kinds of brain cells, neurons and supporting cells called glia, but they tend to be replenished throughout the lifespan. The neurons are replenished in very few areas of the brain, but important areas, such as an area called the hippocampus that has a lot to do with us encoding new memories or creating a past, without which we wouldn't be able to create the past. So we know from many decades of animal research now and some very creative human research that neurons and other cells and the supporting structure and the neurochemistry are replenished in many ways throughout the adult lifespan. There's certainly limits in the plasticity or the flexibility of human brains and non-human animal brains changes and decreases as we get older. But there are ways to enhance brain and cognitive plasticity. That is, it is possible even to improve your memory and decision-making and verbal abilities as we age.
Mm. And I suppose you have to say that it is true that there can be some organic brain conditions. There are diseases that can lead to death of brain cells. So,
sure.
So it's not that that's not possible, that can happen, but that's not normal. That's not the norm.
Right. Certainly, there are many age-associated disorders such as Parkinson's and many forms of dementia. Alzheimer's is probably the best known, and we are beginning to understand the underlying mechanisms, the biochemistry and the molecular and cellular changes that take place. We don't have any cures for most of these diseases. We have ways to keep them at bay for short periods of time, but believe it or not, there's more and more data, more and more evidence that suggests that the choices we make in our lives and sometimes the choices that life makes for us can have implications for how well we function as we get older.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that we'll talk all about that. Maybe let me ask this question. Some of this increased understanding about the brain over the course of life is relatively recent.
Mm-hmm.
What
yes.
is it that has enabled us to get this better understanding?
Well, with both human and animal research, the continued improvement of various techniques that allow us to gain insights into how the brain functions, both the structure and function of the brain. With humans, we are somewhat limited. We don't do the histology until you're done using your brain. With animals, we can use other techniques. And in fact, techniques continue to improve. The human techniques have really taken off with functional magnetic resonance imaging and transcranial magnetic stimulation and a number of techniques that are still under development today and probably will be for quite some time. But they really allow us to provide insights into brain function that we didn't have a decade or two decades ago. And these insights will continue to improve along with the technology and the signal processing and so forth that allow us to gain some of these insights.
Yeah, it's those kind of technologies that allow you to take a living person and watch their brain at work.
And we do it all the time. In the basement of the Beckman Institute, we have several MRI machines similar to the ones that exist in hospitals, better in many ways. They're higher field machines. We can image animals' brains as they're in the machines, or humans' brains as we have them play a video game or try to remember a sentence or pairs of faces and locations and professions and things such as that. We do this every day.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can talk. We can talk a little bit more about the term plasticity, because that's
sure.
one that one hears a lot. And I'm not exactly sure if you talk about plasticity in the brain, what people think when they hear that. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, it really means different things at different levels of description. In terms of the brain, it would suggest that there's some potential for the stuff of the brain, the various cells and the interconnections, to continue to encode new information, encode new memories, learning, and so forth. The interesting question is whether there are ways to enhance that plasticity. As we get older, it becomes harder to learn new information, to remember new things. Are there methods that might aid us in terms of enhancing the functionality of some of the underlying structure? In terms of describing plasticity at a higher level, more of a cognitive level or a memory level, the question is, can we actually achieve some of the feats of memory or various forms of information processing that we could when we were 20 or 30, when we're 60? Are there ways to get us there? Maybe it takes a little longer, but can we get to those points?
So that's for me, it's interesting. This is maybe a more broad kind of way of thinking about plasticity. Mm-hmm. When I hear that, I suppose I think about how it is that you see that, for example, if you have an injury to a particular mm-hmm. part of the brain, say you have a stroke
mm-hmm.
and you have an injury to a particular area, that we have actually seen other parts of the brain can take over the functions that the damaged part had.
Right. That's certainly one possibility. It's often called compensation. So if a brain region is irreparably damaged, as it could be in a stroke, there may be other brain regions that have connections to the brain regions that help do that function, whether it's memory or decision making, and now they'll be used. Maybe they weren't dominant, but they can do the function. So that's one way to go. In terms of plasticity, another way to think of plasticity is, can you take cells that are still functional but maybe not functioning very well because they don't have the right neurochemistry or other support, and can you actually make them function better through various kinds of interventions or choices or whatnot?
Yeah. Our guest, let me just very quickly reintroduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Art Kramer. He's professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois in the Department of Psychology, also works in the campus neuroscience program, and also in the Institute of Aviation. He is also a full-time faculty member in the Beckman Institute Human Perception and Performance Group. And we're talking about the brain and how it changes over the course of life, what kind of changes you should expect, but also the fact that in recent years we have more and more research that shows that that the brain continues to have the ability to grow and change as people get older, and that there are things that can be done to enhance performance and enhance memory as we get older. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Just, I think we've got a caller here, and I'm going to get to that person in just a second, but to go back to this idea that brain function declines with age, and maybe again this goes back to this notion that people have this idea that the brain it wears out, and that's if people's memory is not as sharp, if their reaction time is not as quick, if they don't learn as quickly when they were younger, that somehow that has to do with structural changes. Mm-hmm. And it seems that now the idea more is that's not so much the case, and we're not thinking that neurons are dying off or anything like that, but that this probably has something to do with changes in the brain chemistry?
It certainly has to do with the chemistry. There are these substances called neurotransmitters that allow the neurons and other cells to communicate with each other, and they tend to be downregulated to some extent. That is, there's less of them, or their receptors aren't quite as effective. Chemicals like dopamine that play an important role in learning and being able to move around the world and many other functions. So certainly the neurochemistry changes. We used to think that the neurons died as we got older, and they do if you have some age-associated disorders, such as Alzheimer's disease. There is cell death, which is called apoptosis. Sometimes that's a good thing if you need to prune cells that aren't functioning well. Sometimes not such a good thing, like Alzheimer's or vascular dementia or so forth. But most of the changes that take place, or many of the changes, don't have to do with the death of neurons during normal, non-pathological aging, but changes in the brain chemistry, sometimes changes in the connections among different brain regions, these structures called axons that allow us to connect different regions of the brain and communicate information, much like a telephone wire or a wireless network might.
Yeah. I have some callers here we'll get right to, but I don't want to make it sound like I'm promoting the idea that some sort of medication can solve any problem. Mm-hmm. But as we do have medications that are intended to adjust brain chemistry as a way of dealing with psychopathology, right, things like depression or schizophrenia or anxiety disorder or some wide range of things. Is there any thought that somehow by intervening and having some effect on brain chemistry that some of the things that we have talked about, ability to learn, memory, performance on challenging tasks and so forth, for the average person might be improved by doing some kind of chemical intervention?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Most of the drugs that are developed in the United States, the way the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, works is you can't at present get a drug approved for a normal person. It has to be targeted towards a disease. Now, there are drugs that are undergoing trials either with non-human animals or humans. This is a long process, drug approval, and it's not my main area of research. These drugs may very well be useful in enhancing memory, both in an Alzheimer's patient who clearly has problems with memory and in someone without Alzheimer's, someone who's functioning normally. But we haven't gotten around to deciding what to do with these drugs in normal folks. We tend to target diseases. And there are a lot of drugs that are being developed now to treat Alzheimer's dementia. We don't have any drugs that will cure it, and that may be quite a while. I'm not sure exactly when, but my bet is in the next 10 to 15 years, given all of the drugs that are undergoing trials and that attack Alzheimer's at different points in the molecular and cellular pathway, that we at least have the chance within the next 10 or 15 years to render Alzheimer's as a chronic disease like HIV/AIDS, in which you might take a cocktail of drugs as well as a behavioral prescription of things you should change in your life, and you might very well be able to hold it at bay. That isn't possible today, certainly. Yeah. And there are no drugs that are available that cure Alzheimer's or even change the progression very much, perhaps for a few months or so.
Yeah, I suppose part of the problem is that by the time you might get around to intervening, the disease process has been at work for some time.
That's very true, and there's debate as to how long that is. There are some studies that look at individuals who are genetically at risk for Alzheimer's. There's a gene called APOE that depending upon the alleles that you have on this gene, you would have a much higher chance of getting Alzheimer's. And there have been studies that have looked at people in their 30s with this particular gene and found that they tend to be a little abnormal even in their 30s. So when exactly to intervene is an important question, and how much benefit do you get either behaviorally with lifestyle choices or perhaps with pharmaceuticals? Do you get at different points in the progression of the disease? Alzheimer's, at least for some that are genetically susceptible to it, might start quite early but might not be noticeable for 30 or 40 years.
Well, we have some callers to talk with. Let us do that. And we will start with someone who's in Bloomington on our line 4, the toll-free line, right here. Hello.
Hi. I'm assuming that the sense of balance is a brain function. So may I ask about loss of balance, loss of sense of balance in the old age? I'm 74, and I exercise by riding a bicycle. I have no trouble balancing my bicycle when I'm riding without a load. But I like to bring groceries home on my bike. I have baskets in front and in back of my bike, and with 35 or 40 pounds of groceries in those baskets, balance becomes more difficult. And it seems to me that when I'm riding with my bike fully loaded, I don't feel as sure as I used to. I feel like I'm less stable. My question is, do we lose sense of balance as we age? And if so, what can we do about it?
I think that's an excellent question. You mentioned you're in your 70s, mid-70s?
74.
Well, if you can ride your bike with 30 or 40 pounds of groceries, you're doing very well. All of us would be more unstable with that kind of weight in the back of our bike. There's no doubt about that. But our balance and our ability to control posture as we're riding a bike or walking certainly changes as a function of age. And it sounds like you're already doing some of the right things. You said you're exercising. There are many different kinds of exercises that you could do, certainly aerobic exercise, riding a bike or walking or swimming or doing aerobic exercises in a pool are very important for maintaining physical and mental function. And I guess we'll get to that throughout the program.
Sure.
But there have also been a number of studies that have shown that techniques various training protocols such as yoga and Tai Chi help with balance control. Some of that work has been done here at the University of Illinois by a former colleague who's now at Northwestern and others. So I would look into the kinds of training techniques that really focus on balance. Tai Chi would be a good one. Yoga would be a good one. There might be programs in your local senior citizen center, and that should help a little bit with balance. But it sounds to me like you're doing quite well. There is instability when you put a heavy load on the back of a bike and hit a few bumps.
There sure is. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Good. Let's go on here to another caller, and this is Ann Champagne. This is someone in line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yep. Well, we lost the caller, and I'm my apologies. I'm not sure how it is that happened. If the caller would like to call back, we'd be happy to get him on. Other questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we touched on this a couple times. Rather than say we'll talk about it later, I want to make sure that we talk about these things that people can do to help to bolster and maintain brain function.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you've talked about is exercise, physical exercise. Are there some particular forms of exercise or frequency of exercise that are recommended?
My recommendation is many forms of exercise, but the kind of exercise we tend to study here at the University of Illinois is referred to as aerobic exercise. And I've been studying this for many years with my colleague Eddie McCauley in the Department of Kinesiology and our students and postdocs and so forth. Also my colleague Chuck Hillman in kinesiology. And the reason we're interested in aerobic exercise, one important reason is that most of the animal research on exercise focuses on wheel running or treadmill running, because that's what little rodents do very well. And we know a lot about the underlying molecular and cellular biology, the changes in the brain and the body that take place from aerobic exercise. And what we've learned over the years, and others, this is becoming a very large field, And it's hard sometimes hard to get at the truth in the public media, but I'll try to provide what we know today. Mm-hmm. And what we do know with humans is that aerobic exercise, and by aerobic exercise, I don't mean getting prepared to run a marathon or do a triathlon. People often ask me this. But in our studies, we take sedentary adults from about 60 to 80 years of age, and we get them involved in an exercise program that takes about 45 minutes to an hour a day, and they're walking, simply walking. And by the end of 6 months or a year, it's three times a week is what we do, they're walking further and faster, but nobody's winning any races. So you really don't have to be exercising at very high intensities. And what we find is, as a function of these, this newfound love of exercise, and people do continue often, that they improve in memory about 15 to 20% after 6 months, improve in decision-making, improve in their ability to attend to various things and shift their attention. A real-world example would be in driving an automobile, you have to attend to the pedestrians and other vehicles and bicyclists, but control the car and maybe talk to your passenger. Hopefully you're not talking on a cell phone, very bad thing to do. And these kinds of skills, the skills that underlie many real-world behaviors, improve. And we know that from the testing we do in our laboratory. However, we also are interested in how the brain changes and supports these memory and attentional and decision-making changes. So the participants in our studies get into the big MRI machines that we have in the Beckman Institute, and we scan their brains both in terms of the structure and examine how the structure might change, but also the function as they're doing various tasks, as they're presented with information to remember or asked to select one item out of many items in a cluttered screen, kind of like driving in a busy downtown area like Chicago on Lakeshore Drive. And then we can image how the brain is supporting these kinds of functions. And what we find there is that the brain becomes more efficient. That is, when we look at the neural networks that underlie memory and underlie decision-making and attention and so forth, they actually become more like that of younger people, which is really pretty interesting and certainly didn't need to work out that way. In terms of structure, we actually find increases in volume, increases in the amount of tissue in both the gray matter, those would be the cell bodies, the neurons, and the supporting structure, the glia, and also the white matter, the interconnections among different areas of the brain. Now, what we can't know simply from human research or what are the underlying mechanisms, the cellular and molecular mechanisms that underlie those changes in volume. But what we are doing now is parallel animal models so that we can actually look at these changes at many different levels and try to understand the mechanisms that lend themselves to these structural and functional changes.
Well, that would naturally probably would have been my next question. And I wonder if you have some sort of ideas about why it is that this kind of exercise has this effect.
Yeah. Yeah, we have many ideas, but that's what they are, speculation, theory, I suppose. We know from the animal research that there's an increase in various proteins called neurotrophins. And neurotrophins are protective proteins. If you fall, if that last caller, I hope he never does, but if he fell off his bike on his head, you'd want those things to be present because they actually decrease inflammation and help you to cope with various injuries. So that's one reason that we want these neurotrophins around. Another reason is that they tend to promote the connections among neurons that can encode new information, new memories, and even something called neurogenesis, the birth of new neurons throughout the lifespan, which is usually a good thing. So the increases in these various proteins, one of them is brain-derived neurotrophin, and names aren't important, but there are many of them, happen as a function of exercise, aerobic exercise. There's also changes in the little power factories that exist within cells called mitochondria. They tend to increase. What we don't know is whether there's one starting point that gets all this going, but we know there are a number of changes that promote more flexible and plastic brains that then support increased memory and decision-making and attention and right. So forth.
I believe we have a caller back, the one we lost, so let's get them. Line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I've noticed that my fiancé worked for the elderly, and it seems like many of them are really sharp. And then when we noticed a sharp decline in their mental capabilities, they seem to die soon after. And I wonder if there's any research that correlates to that sort of sudden decline in mental abilities and death.
Yes, indeed there is. There's a researcher by the name of James Beeren, who's probably now in his late 80s. He's still a professor at UCLA, and he discovered a number of years ago with his colleagues that changes in cognition, simple responses, let's say you have a red button or a green button on the computer, and when one of them lights up, you push one button on the keyboard, and the other one lights up, push another button. Simple reaction times or response times seem to predict when someone might die. So there's often a strong correlation between how well you function mentally and whether you'll be around for the long term. And it's interesting because there have been a lot of studies looking at changes in memory and decision-making and attention and linguistic abilities throughout the lifespan. And one set of studies is called cross-sectional, where you look at people at different ages, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 50, 70, 80-year-olds. And there you see this linear decline. So it looks like it's really good to be 18 because from that time forward, the news is bad. And at my age, I'm in my mid-50s, the news wouldn't be too good in these cross-sectional studies. But the longitudinal studies, which are really hard to do because it requires that you get a group of people who are willing to be in your study for 50, 60, 70 years, so there aren't many of them, they show a long period of stability, as you mentioned, as you were commenting, and then a fairly rapid decline. And that long period of stability often includes the 60s and the 70s, and then people go downhill. But you're exactly right that changes in cognition can actually predict how close you are to the end of your life.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm 54, so I won't worry too much.
No, you have a few good years. We both do.
Okay, well, thank you
for
very
the call.
Much.
Sure.
And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Art Kramer. He's professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Also works in the campus neuroscience program, has involvement in the Institute of Aviation, and is full-time faculty member in the Beckman Institute Human Perception and Performance Group. And we're talking about what it is now the people who study the brain can tell us about how the brain changes over time. And questions are welcome. And there, you just touched on something that I think is again, worth underscoring, is that, you know, you may be able to indeed learn some things by looking at a group of people in their 20s and compare that to a group of people in their 40s and a group of people in their 80s. Mm-hmm. But then you are also, if you have the opportunity to look at individuals, you know that from one individual to another individual, things are very different. So what you'd, as you say, what you'd really like to do is you'd like to have some people that you could study that person, mm-hmm. a group of people, for their entire life, mm-hmm. so that you could see how that line followed from one person, mm-hmm. because, you know, there are going to be big differences between individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that we see when we look at lifespan cognition or lifespan brain function is that there's increasing variability also mm-hmm. as we get older, because people have had different life experiences, both positive and negative. We all do, and we have to certainly learn to roll with the punches, as they say. We also have different genetics, and there's been a lot of arguments about whether genetics are more important early or later in life, and there's data supporting both points. But I think the important point is that genetics and lifetime experiences, both those positive experiences, and by the way, if there are any young people listening to this program, the best thing you can do for yourself, I know when you're 15 or 20, you don't want to think about being 70 or 80. I certainly didn't either. Now I'm getting closer. Maybe I think a little bit more about that. But the best thing you can do, one of the best predictors of how well you'll fare when you're old, is education. So get a lot of education. And one way to think about it, and one way the researchers do think about education, is that it provides a brain or cognitive reserve. So even if you have damage, and we all do, one way or the other, from choices we've made or accidents we've had, that more education allows you to compensate for changes in the brain that may have led to performing or not remembering so well or not making decisions quickly or so forth. So education is actually one of our best predictors of lifetime function and continued function in terms of memory, decision-making, and so forth. There are many other things you can do, and I'm sure we'll talk about.
Well, and just I have another caller here, but just real quick, you know, we were just talking about the importance of regular aerobic exercise, mm-hmm. that's good for the brain. I think also if you ask this question, well, in terms of lifestyle, you know, what would be important, it seems that all of the things that we're told are good for maintaining heart health, mm-hmm. reducing your risk of heart attack, reducing your risk of stroke, reducing your risk of diabetes, all those things are also good for brain health.
That's very true. So I think of many of these choices we make as having long-term and short-term effects. And we know about the short-term effects from the rodent work because mice don't live that long, so they tend to be pretty short-term. And the long-term effects, such as none of us want a heart attack if we can prevent it, or a stroke because it's tough to recover and we don't always recover fully. So being very active physically will reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes and hypertension and diabetes and forms of cancer and osteoporosis. It's a win-win situation. But also, exercise and other choices we make will improve various aspects of mental function by changing and improving various aspects of brain function. So there are almost these two routes to maintaining high levels of brain and cognitive function, prevent disease that will make it tough to function well. But in addition to that, these various interventions or choices make even these short-term improvements or so forth.
All right. We have some other callers. Next in line is Champagne. Someone on line one. Hello.
Hi, good
yes.
morning.
Mm-hmm.
I tuned in a little late. If I'm repeating something, I apologize. Have you looked at the role of estrogen and even testosterone in brain function for memory and intelligence? I certainly noticed a drop-off after I reached that certain age, and replacing estrogen hasn't helped as much as I would have liked. And I know some men who replace their testosterone because they're trying to get back to where they were when they were 18 mentally as well as physically, and I wondered if you took a look at any of that.
We've done some work, just the cross-sectional studies. We've looked at women who have chosen to take hormone replacement therapy when they become perimenopausal or menopausal, and those who have not, and looked at how that interacts with exercise and whether that predicts maintenance of memory and different cognitive functions. And we have found in these cross-sectional studies, they're imperfect. We really want to do the longitudinal studies, that there has been maintenance of brain structure and also maintenance of various forms of cognition for women who have chosen to take hormone replacement therapy. Now, this is a very controversial issue, let me state outright, because there's a series of studies that come from the Women's Health Initiative that started in the early 1990s that found that women that were on long-term protocols of hormone replacement therapy, albeit different kinds of therapies than we would do today, tended to have some really negative effects in terms of heart disease, and strokes, and so forth. So there really may be trade-offs. I don't think we know the bottom line answer here, because protocols for hormone replacement therapy have changed, and the women who participated in this study tended to be on an average of 12 or 13 years after menopause. And that's not the way physicians treat menopause. But there is ongoing research on hormone replacement therapy, less so for men than women, but also for men, and its effects on general health as well as cognition. If you look at the animal research for hormone replacement, and animals are different models, and the hormones are depleted in different ways than they are in normal human aging for the most part, you see many benefits. In fact, we have a researcher on campus, a number of them, but Donna Carroll does a lot of research with rodents on exercise and how it interacts with replacing hormones when the rodents lose their hormones. But this is a controversial area. There's still much research to be done.
Well, if you do any research, sign me up. I'm very interested.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to another caller. This is someone on line number two, also Champagne. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have two questions that I'll pose, and then I'll listen off the air.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is about second language acquisition and cognition, and I'm a foreign language teacher, so I'm kind of interested in this in all ages. But also, because I'm older than 50, I'm interested in the second language acquisition and cognition with older learners and all different types of learners, because I think basically we think of, you know, someone, you know, a senior taking a foreign language class because they want to go to Mexico on vacation or something like that. But there's such a huge movement of increasingly older people around the planet for economic reasons and all kinds of reasons, and people of different socioeconomic classes, and the language learning challenges they face and especially for older people. And then secondly, I'm curious if you know anything about the European Union has an educational program also for all ages. It's called the Lifelong Learning Program. And they have a special section for older people that's called Grundtvig, after a Danish educator, I believe. And then they have another section about language learning. And I think maybe they look at especially older people and language learning. And I'm wondering if you know anything, if they do anything like what you do, or anything along those lines would be of interest to me. Thank you very much. I tried to keep it short, but I hope I succeeded.
Okay,
that's
and
great.
I am going to tell you that I wrote it down because I don't trust my memory. So I have the questions. I don't have to ask again. So the first question was about second language learning and whether that's good for us at any age. And the answer is, based on what we know, it is. There are critical periods for learning language, which means that if we learn it early, and we don't quite do this correctly in our schools yet, I'm hoping, and in Europe they do, because you have to speak many languages to live in many different countries in Europe. But starting early is thought to be a good thing, to learn a language well and to be able to pronounce all of the sounds in a language. But despite that, we can learn a language at any age, and there is an increasing body of literature, and it's fairly early times here, work done in Canada and elsewhere by Gus Craik and Ellen Bialystock in Toronto. And what they've been looking at is, well, whether older people who were bilingual — French Canadians tend to be bilingual, many Canadians are, that's another problem we have here, of course, that we tend not to be bilingual — but these individuals tend to fare better as they get older in terms of maintaining memory and cognition. So learning multiple languages might give us an edge later on, might allow us to have some cognitive reserve, much as education in general will. You also asked about older people learning new languages and whether that's a good thing. It tends to be more challenging than when we're very young, but certainly we can learn new languages at any time in our life. And if we look at the epidemiological data — this is the data that looks at what you do at one point in time, waits some number of years, let's say a decade, and there's more and more of this data all the time — and then asks whether what you do at one time is predictive of how well you fare, either in terms of being diagnosed with disease like Alzheimer's, or just maintenance of normal cognition when you don't have such a disease, and has found that activities that tend to be novel, challenging activities, like learning to play an instrument that you don't know how to play, or learning a new language, tend to be predictive of better maintenance of cognition and a decreased probability of being diagnosed with Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. So learning a new language has a number of benefits at any age, and there is much ongoing research, some of it being done at the University of Illinois and other places. Your second question had to do with the European Union and the program you mentioned there, the Lifelong Learning Program. There are such programs all over the world. In fact, we have one in Champaign run by Kathleen Holden. It's called the OSHA Lifelong Learning Institute, and it's out in the research park, a little bit south of campus. So it's OLI, or OSHA Lifelong Learning Institute. I'm pretty sure you can find it on a university homepage, because it's sponsored in part by the Osher Institute and the University of Illinois. And that's a program that really encourages lifelong learning. So faculty members from Parkland, the University of Illinois, and anybody that has information to convey provides classes, and all kinds of classes, in just about any subject, including neuroscience. We've actually done some classes there in the past, and lectures, where if you're over 50, and Kathleen keeps encouraging me to come out there — but right now I get my share of intellectual stimulation, and perhaps a little later I'd certainly like to sit in on classes rather than teach them all the time. So we provide such programs here on campus, and research is done on various training protocols. Liz Stein-Morrow at the Beckman Institute has a program called Odyssey of the Mind, which some of you might have heard with reference to children. It's open-ended problem solving in engineering or in literature or a variety of different topics that she gets older adults involved in, and then measures changes in memory and various abilities. So the European Union is clearly doing this work. I have many good friends there in Sweden and Germany and the Netherlands and so forth. But we also do our share of such research here. And in fact, there's more and more collaborative research across the world in Asia, North America, South America, America as well as Europe. And I think that's important because there are often cultural differences in terms of preferences for what people might want to do or attitudes about aging that are important in determining how well we function and what we're willing to do.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. I have a caller I'm going to get right to in just a second. I do, however, want to take that much time to introduce again our guest, Art Kramer. He's professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois in the Department of Psychology. And we're talking about some of the research that he and other people have been involved in looking at how the brain changes across the adult lifespan and really getting at the idea that unlike what I think many people think, that the brain does indeed continue to change and grow throughout life and that there is not an inevitable kind of decline that comes with aging. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here is another caller on our toll free line, line 4. Hello. Is our caller there?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello, is this me?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Okay, you did not say line 4, excuse me. It curiouses me that psychology as a science seems to very often eliminate the definition of the word psyche or psycho, as the definition from the Greek language has to do with the breath of life in the mind and spirit and soul of man. Why is psychology a science that refuses or censors those terms of which the problems of religion over the world creates problems? I will listen off the air. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's a great question, but I don't think psychology does ignore issues of spirituality and religion. In fact, there are a number of researchers who are interested in how religion or spirituality more generally affects various cognitive processes throughout the lifespan. And there have been, I'd mentioned these epidemiological studies in the past that look at what you report doing at one point in time and then wait a period of time and see how well you're faring. And actually being involved in religious kinds of activities is another predictor of faring well. Now, whether that has to do specifically with being involved in religious activities or the fact that religious activities tend to involve a lot of social interaction, which we also know is neuroprotective, that is, protects the brain and the mind, we don't know. But psychology doesn't ignore religion and spirituality. Not everybody studies it. I don't. But we all have limited experience, even though we like to be well-read and know lots of things. But psychologists and neuroscientists, by the way, do study spirituality and religion.
We have a little bit of time left here. Again, folks who want to call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something I want to make certain that we talk about here in the time that we have left is another kind of exercise. We've talked about the importance of physical exercise to maintaining cognitive functioning, but there is also good reason to believe that what we might call mental exercise also has a positive effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and mental exercise has been looked at in a variety of ways. In these epidemiological studies, people report what they do. So they may go to theater. They belong to a book group. They like to read. They like to learn to play new musical instruments, learn languages, a variety of things. And these things tend to be added up, how often you do them, how challenging they are, and so forth. And we know from a lot of research throughout the world, but as local as Chicago, Dave Bennett and Bob Wilson at Rush Presbyterian or Rush University Medical School have found that individuals who partake in these challenging intellectual activities, whatever they may be, also fare better. So being involved in mental activities and the ones that tend to be best, and this is based on a large corpus of research, but certainly more is needed, tend to be new activities. So one may ask, I do crossword puzzles, somebody may say. I don't personally. And will that be protective? And the answer seems to be, again, there's certainly more research needs to be done, that if you picked up crossword puzzles when you're in your 50s and 60s and it was a new activity, just like you might have learned a new language or learned to play the piano if you never played the piano before, those new challenging activities tend to be the best predictors of maintenance of cognition, not necessarily things you've done your whole life. But being intellectually engaged, as it's called in the literature, tends to be quite important also.
Again, I want to make sure that folks who are listening know if you want to, if you have a question, you can call up real quick. We'll see if we can get you in. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something I also wanted to get you to talk a little bit about, and I was thinking earlier, this came to mind when you were talking about those things that you see earlier in people's lives. What's going to be a predictor of good cognitive functioning later.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you said was a good predictor was education. So
yes.
You want to say to people who are young, get as much education as possibly can. And I don't know exactly if this is connected, but I was thinking about the study that you did looking at air traffic controllers and comparing younger ones with older ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the United States, most air traffic controllers retire at 55 or 56 years of age when they turn 56. You can get a waiver, but it's pretty tough to work later than that. In Europe, it's later. In Canada, it's later. So we were asking in this study, we were asking a pretty simple question, a couple of questions. And one was, if you're between 55 and 65, can you do the job and can you do it well? Because this is a job where you don't want many mistakes, like many jobs, I think, being a surgeon, for example. So we went up to Canada, where they actually do work up into 65, and we created a number of computer-based simulations of air traffic control. And frankly, that's pretty easy to do. Because when you think of air traffic control, it's a high-stakes video game. You're looking at the computer monitor. You're assigning planes to altitudes and airspaces and various routes and so forth. There's a lot of stress. You really can't afford to make too many mistakes, at least not critical ones. So we built these simulations, and we compared young controllers, 30-somethings, to individuals between 55 and 65, and found that there was no difference. In fact, sometimes there were performance and improvements in favor of the older air traffic controllers. And a second question we asked is, are these older controllers super older folks? Well, not older folks, middle-aged folks, 55 to 65. So we gave them a battery of standard neurological and neuropsychological tests and had non-older air traffic controllers, non-air traffic controllers that were 30-somethings, as well as the air traffic controllers in both groups. And we found for the most part that the older air traffic controllers scored the same in terms of declining memory and cognition and so forth as the older folks in general that didn't have this very stimulating high-stress job environment. So what seems to be happening, at least on the basis of these data and others, is that we gain a wealth of experience as we go through life and work at whatever profession we're involved in. And this experience, it's often called crystallized intelligence, can offset some of the changes in more power abilities or fluid intelligence, like how fast we react or how much we remember. There are various strategies air traffic controllers use to maintain memory. The interesting thing is that experience or knowledge can really offset some of these other changes in a positive way.
Yeah. Well, that's something that I find both interesting and comforting, and maybe a little bit, the idea that if, as you age, you will expect that some things will change, that maybe your memory won't be quite as sharp, your reaction time won't mm-hmm. be as fast. Maybe your ability to learn new things, it won't be as easy. I'm not saying it's not possible, it won't be as easy. But that something that you might actually get away with calling wisdom, which maybe has something to do with accumulated experience, mm-hmm. actually does come into play,
mm-hmm.
and that can help in some sense to balance maybe some of the deficits in these other areas.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent way to think about it. And there is a branch of psychology called psychometrics that does a quantitative analysis of change over life. And we find that these fluid abilities, things like memory, working memory, short-term memory, or how fast we react and so forth, they do decline. And the question is, at what rate and how can we change the rate and so forth? But these other abilities, these crystallized or knowledge-based abilities, tend to continue to increase well into the 70s. So we can think of this as an offsetting of some of these more power-based, speeded abilities by knowledge-based abilities. And this is what allows us all to function very well. And fortunately for you, David, your linguistic abilities are quite wonderful, and this allows you to offset some of the other changes.
Yes. Well, one other thing, and again, I think this is something that interests me. We talk about the fact that with aging, learning new things, it's not quite as easy. Again, we don't say it's not impossible. It's not quite as easy. The thing that I think is really interesting is this idea that what really helps in learning, and perhaps also it's good for cognitive functioning, is to you got to shake things up. That is, if you keep sort of doing the same things in the same ways, working with the same kind of data, looking at the same sort of information, looking at the world in the same way, thinking about things in the same way, seeking out information that already fits with what you've already mm-hmm. got, mm-hmm. that if you depart from that, if you, metaphorically speaking, go down a different road, bring new stuff in, this is actually very good.
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that novelty is a good thing when it comes to intellectual challenge, and that is what the literature suggests and what the data suggests. So for the listeners, please go out and learn new things, whatever you'd like. Play a new instrument. Learn a new language. I travel around the world all the time. This weekend I'll be in Zurich and Germany, and I can say my German is pretty lousy, but I work at it. I do my best to learn.
And even apparently, if you're that learning can be enhanced by bringing in new ideas, or you know, or perhaps a kind of a viewpoint that's by deliberately seeking out viewpoints that are very different from the ones that you have.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to adopt the new viewpoint,
right.
But getting that in there also is somehow has a way of enhancing your ability to learn new things, not necessarily that you're going to change your mind about something.
Right. Yeah, I think that's clearly true, that looking at issues and problems from different perspectives and trying to understand those perspectives, not that you always have to change your mind, we do sometimes and not other times, is another way to keep yourself intellectually challenged, to try to understand various issues from different viewpoints.
Mm-hmm. Well, here we have about a minute or so left. As a basic kind of advice that you would give to people who want to maintain their cognitive functioning, mm-hmm. what would you say?
I'd say there are four important things. Stay socially active. Friends are a good thing. High-quality social interactions. Stay intellectually challenged, however you enjoy doing that. Get some exercise, and you don't have to become a triathlete. That's not necessary. And finally, my personal Achilles heel is diet. But we know from much research with animals and humans, the diets that are high in antioxidants and omega-3s, that is fish, leafy green vegetables, blueberries, strawberries, tend to promote better functioning also throughout the lifespan. So diet, social interaction, intellectual challenge, and physical activity.
All right. Good things all around for all those other things that we mentioned as well. Mm-hmm. If you want to be healthy, it seems like a fairly standard a set of advice that applies in a lot of different areas.
I agree. It's not rocket science, but it is brain science.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure.
We appreciate it. Art Kramer, he's professor of psychology in the Department of Psychology here at University of Illinois. Support for the broadcast today comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy at Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana. A zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at subaruofchampaign.com or 352-4700. We're WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We will break, as we usually do at this point, and then we'll come back with another hour of focus. And in the second hour, we'll be talking about some proposed changes to that school reform legislation known as No Child Left Behind. First, though, we'll bring you an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.